up the position of street cleaning commissioner in New York. Roosevelt was dreadfully harassed by the offer. 13 years before, when he first stood up in his evening clothes to speak at Morton Hall, he had addressed himself to the subject of street cleaning. But something told him that his future lay elsewhere than in garbage collection. He declined with exquisite tact, obviously hoping for a more suitable offer. In the meantime, there was more than enough federal business to keep him occupied. President Cleveland had at last begun to extend the classified service. John Proctor was responding well to Roosevelt's training. Another season of hard work would put the capstone on his achievements as civil service commissioner. The year 1895 opened snowy and crisp, and Roosevelt plunged into the familiar round of receptions and balls and diplomatic breakfasts, to which he was by now shamelessly addicted. "I always eat and drink too much," he mourned. "Still, it is so pleasant to deal with big interests and big men." A particularly big interest loomed in February. Revolutionaries in Cuba, Spain's last substantial fragment of empire in the New World, declared war on the power that had oppressed them for centuries. Instantly, expansionists in the capital began to discuss the pros and cons of supporting the cause of Cuban independence. Henry Adams's salon at 1603 H Street became a hotbed of international intrigue, with Cabot Lodge and John Hay weighing the strategic and economic advantages of U.S. intervention, and Clarence King rhapsodizing over the charms of Cuban women. Roosevelt, true to form, dashed off a note to Governor Levi P. Morton of New York, begging that, in the very improbable event of war with Spain, he would be included in any regiment the state sent out. "Remember, I make application now. I must have a commission in the force that goes to Cuba." As for big men, he encountered on 7 March a genius greater than any he had yet met, with the possible exception of Henry James. Rudyard Kipling was not quite 30, but he was already the world's most famous living writer, and Roosevelt hastened to invite him to dinner. At first, they did not get on too well. Kipling, Roosevelt wrote, was bright, nervous, voluble, and underbred, and displayed an occasional truculence toward America which required very rough handling. Kipling's manners improved, and the two men became fond of each other. Roosevelt introduced Kipling to his literary and political acquaintances, escorted him to the zoo to see grizzlies, and to the Smithsonian to see Indian relics. From time to time he thanked God in a loud voice that he had not one drop of British blood in him. When Kipling amusedly mocked the self-righteousness of a nation that had extirpated its aboriginals more completely than any modern race has done, Roosevelt made the glass cases of the museum shake with his rebuttals. Roosevelt's activity became more and more strenuous as spring approached. He dashed in and out of town on civil service commission business, taught himself to ski, bombarded his friends in the New York City government with advice and suggestions, continued to toil on Volume 4 of The Winning of the West, and collaborated with Cabot Lodge on a book for boys, Hero Tales from American History. Friends noticed hints of inner turbulence. He was seen blinking pitifully with exhaustion at a dinner for Owen Wister and Kipling, and his tirades on a currently fashionable topic, whether dangerous sports should be banned in the nation's universities, became alarmingly harsh. "What matters a few broken bones to the glories of intercollegiate sport?" he cried at a Harvard Club dinner. Meanwhile, not far away in hospital, the latest victim of football savagery lay paralyzed for life. He declared publicly that he would disinherit any son of his who refused to play college games, and in private, through clenched teeth, "I would rather one of them should die than have them grow up as weaklings." Clearly, he was under considerable personal strain. The reason soon became evident. He was torn between his longing to join Mayor Strong's reform administration in New York and his instinct to stay put until the next presidential election. Toward the end of March, he told Lemuel Quigg that he would like to be one of the 4 New York police commissioners, but waxed coy when Quigg said it could be arranged. He dispatched Lodge to New York to discuss the matter further. "The average New Yorker, of course, wishes me to take it very much," Roosevelt mused on 3 April. "I don't feel much like it myself. On the other hand, it was a glamorous job, one I could perhaps afford to be identified with." Before the day was out, he had reached his decision. To Lemuel Eli Quigg, Washington, April 3, 1895. "Lodge will see you and tell you. I will accept subject to honorable conditions. Keep this strictly confidential. Theodore Roosevelt. The appointment was confirmed on 17 April, by which time Roosevelt was quite reconciled to leaving Washington. I think it a good thing to be identified with my native city again. Mayor Strong asked him to be ready to take office about the 1st of May. Roosevelt promptly sent his resignation to President Cleveland. I have now been in office almost exactly 6 years, a little over 2 years of the time under yourself, and I leave with the greatest reluctance. During my term of office, I have seen the classified service grow to more than double the size that it was 6 years ago. Year by year, the law has been better executed, taking the service as a whole, and in spite of occasional exceptions in certain offices and bureaus. Since you yourself took office this time, nearly 6,000 positions have been put into the classified service. It has been a pleasure to serve on the commission under you. There goes the best politician in Washington, Cleveland said after bidding him farewell. All the abrasiveness of recent months melted away as Roosevelt joyfully contemplated his achievements in Washington and the challenge awaiting him in New York. He hated to leave the capital at a time when the trees were dense with blossom, and the slow southern girls, so different from their quick-stepping northern sisters, were strolling through the streets in their light summer dresses to the sound of banjos down by the river. He was sorry to say goodbye to nice, peevish old Henry Adams, to Spwing Weiss of the British Legation, and Lodge and Reed and Hay and all the pleasant gang who breakfasted at 1603 H Street. He would miss the Smithsonian, to which he affectionately donated his pair of Minnesota skis, along with several specimens from the long-defunct Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. Most of all, perhaps, he would miss the Cosmos Club, the little old house on Madison Place, where leaders of Washington's scientific community liked to gather for polysyllabic discussions. Ever since Roosevelt's first days as civil service commissioner, when he astonished 20 Cosmos members by effortlessly sorting a pile of fossil bones into skeletons with running commentaries on the life habits of each animal, he had been a star attraction at the club. In later life, Rudyard Kipling, looking back on these spacious and friendly days in Washington, would remember Roosevelt dropping by the Cosmos and pouring out projects, discussions of men and politics, and criticisms of books in a torrential stream, punctuated by bursts of humor. I curled up in the seat opposite and listened and wondered until the universe seemed to be going round, and Theodore was the spinner. Chapter 19. The Biggest Man in New York. Bitter as home-brewed ale were his foaming passions. New York's police headquarters at 300 Mulberry Street was a squat, square building with a marble facade long since yellowed by the fumes of Little Italy. Many a stiletto victim had been carried bleeding up its steep front steps, and countless padrones, awaiting indictments, had glared through its barred basement windows at a little group of reporters lounging on the stoop of number 303 across the way. The reporters, in turn, enjoyed one of the more entertaining vistas in Manhattan. Before them stretched a cobbled street, framed on both sides by tenement buildings and looped around with strings of brilliant laundry. It was an arena always alive with drama, or at least the promise of drama. A sudden singing of the telegraph wires, which untidily connected police headquarters with every precinct in the city, might signify riots in Hell's Kitchen or a brothel bust in the Tenderloin. Sooner or later, the latest victims of the law would be delivered in shiny patrol wagons, and the press would dash across to meet them, pencils and pads at the ready. Even when Mulberry Street was sunk in Monday morning calm, as around 10 o'clock on 6 May 1895, the stoop-sitters were loath to quit their airy perch for the newspaper offices upstairs, actually just stifling cells of the kind that, elsewhere in the neighborhood, sheltered whole families. As long as the breeze did not blow up town from the reeking slums of Mulberry Bend, a man could enjoy his cigar, play poker, and shout humorous insults at the cop on duty opposite. If the sun grew uncomfortably hot, he could send around the corner for iced oysters at a penny each, or stop a passing acquajolo for fresh lemonade. Lincoln Steffens, the talented young correspondent of the Evening Post, was on the stoop that day when Jacob Riis of the Evening Sun came out into the street shouting a telephone message. Theodore Roosevelt had just been sworn in as police commissioner at City Hall, 18 blocks south. He and his three colleagues were already on their way to headquarters to relieve the outgoing commissioners. The news came as no surprise to Steffens. Riis was an old and worshipful friend of Roosevelt's, and had been gloating over his appointment for weeks. It was the will of God that such a reformer should be chosen to purge the notoriously corrupt New York police. Neither did Reese doubt that his man would become president of the new police board. "I don't care who the other commissioners are. TR is enough." About 10:30, an interestingly varied quartet walked around the corner. Leading the way was the bull-necked, bull-chested figure of Theodore Roosevelt. Behind him came a dumpy, middle-aged man bearing an uncanny resemblance to Ulysses S. Grant, and a military-looking youth, very tall and very pale, with a nervous vein beating in his temple. The fourth man seemed to walk somehow apart from the other commissioners, although he was obviously their co-equal, a handsome, lounging, bearded dandy of about 35. Steffens identified them in turn as Frederick D. Grant, Republican, an upstate politician and eldest son of the great general, Avery D. Andrews, Democrat, a graduate of West Point and a rather undistinguished lawyer, and Andrew D. Parker, Democrat, also a lawyer, but one of the cleverest in the city, and a rumored agent of the county Democratic organization. Roosevelt broke into a run when he caught sight of Reese waiting outside number 303. As Steffens remembered it, he came on ahead down the street. He yelled, "Hello, Jake," to Reese, and running up the stairs to the front door of police headquarters, he waved us reporters to follow. We did. With the police officials standing around watching, the new board went up to the second story. TR seized Reese, who introduced me, and still running, he asked questions. "Where are our offices? Where is the boardroom? What do we do first?" Out of the half-heard answers, he gathered the way to the boardroom, where the three old commissioners waited, like three of the new commissioners, stiff, formal, and dignified. Not TR. He introduced himself, his colleagues, with handshakes, and called a meeting of the new board, had himself elected president, this had been prearranged, and then adjourned to pull Reese and me with him into his office. "Now then, what'll we do?" Avery Andrews, writing more than 60 years later, confirmed the accuracy of this account, with the small qualification that Roosevelt's election had not been prearranged. As the senior commissioner in length of service, I called the meeting to order and nominated Roosevelt as president of the board, after which I was elected treasurer. Thus some semblance of bipartisanship was preserved at the outset by distributing control of the police department between the two political parties. "The public," Roosevelt announced in his first presidential statement, "may rest assured that so far as I am concerned, there will be no politics in the department, and I know that I voice the sentiment of my colleagues in that respect. We are all activated by the desire to so regulate this department that it will earn the respect and confidence of the community. All appointments and promotions will be made for merit only, and without regard to political or religious considerations." Although Roosevelt was doubtless pleased to have been given pride of place among his colleagues, he found within 2 days of taking office that the honor was merely titular. On 8 May 1895, Mayor Strong approved an Albany bill which substantially altered the power structure of the New York police. Far from elevating the president of the board above the other commissioners, as a certain assemblyman named Roosevelt had suggested in 1884, the Bipartisan Police Act depressed him to virtually the same level. Since two board members were necessarily Republicans and the other two Democrats, agenda tending to divide the parties would inevitably cause deadlock. Roosevelt knew that these could be resolved only by deal-making or by wrangling. Neither solution appealed to him. The new law, he wrote sarcastically, "modeled the government of the police force somewhat on the lines of the Polish Parliament." It virtually guaranteed that, contrary to what he had just announced, there was going to be plenty of politics as usual in the police department, from the board on down. One of the act's provisions, frustrating to him as a former campaigner against partisan patronage, was to transfer authority over police examinations from the Municipal Civil Service Commission to a special panel of police officers, each of whom, presumably, would be easily bought. The act insisted, further, on equal two-party representation while extending the police board's control of city elections. This, in effect, gave the Republican Party, a perennial minority in New York municipal affairs, disproportionate clout in supervising voter behavior. At the same time, crazily, it seemed designed to thwart any majority decision by the commissioners. "Lest we should get such a majority, it gave each member power to veto the actions of his colleagues in certain very important matters. And lest we should do too much when we were unanimous, it provided that the chief of police, our nominal subordinate, should have entirely independent action and should be practically irremovable. The chief, moreover, was a formidable figure. Commissioners might come and go, but Thomas F. Burns bestrode Mulberry Street with the solidarity of a colossus. At 53, he bade fair to outlast the present board well into the next century. Burns was internationally famous as a detective of almost mystic power, capable of retrieving stolen property at will. "Enough," he would say soothingly to a distraught Fifth Avenue matron. "Your diamonds will be delivered at your house within 3 days." Invariably, they were. Cynical observers like Lincoln Steffens noted that such spectacular achievements were the result of a comfortable arrangement with organized crime. The chief allowed certain lords of the underworld carte blanche, providing their gangs worked regular beats, and cooperated whenever he asked them to return this or that haul for publicity purposes. It was also agreed that the gangs would stay away from the financial district, for Burns had another comfortable arrangement with the lords of Wall Street. Capitalists like Jay Gould did not wish to be disturbed by petty bank heists while they went about the larger business of robbing the United States Treasury, and they were prepared to reward Burns for his protection with favored stocks and bonds. As a result, the chief prospered mightily. By 1895, he was worth at least $350,000, according to his own public estimate. Graft on so majestic a scale could not be expected of other police officers, but Burns's example was an inspiration to all, and the corruption elsewhere was proportionate, according to rank. Reporting directly to the chief were three inspectors, whose corpulent figures and gold-laced uniforms amply symbolized the rewards of office. Then came 35 captains, each of whom controlled a precinct and the revenues thereof. Officers from high vice areas like the Tenderloin waxed noticeably richer than their colleagues. However, even the poorest precinct was worth several thousand a year if properly organized. A regular system of taxation prevailed in most parts of town, whereby the owner of any business, legal or illegal, paid dues based on turnover. Greengrocers would hand over a dollar or two a day for permission to stack fruit on the sidewalk. Owners of gambling houses set aside $15 to $300 a month as insurance against raids. Saloons paid $10,000 for a liquor license. The madam of a brothel might contribute $30,000 over an extended period to her precinct captain, along with more intimate favors upon request. Another form of corruption, job peddling, flourished within the police department itself. Since there were at least two qualified applicants for every one of the force's 38,000 positions, certain market values prevailed. In 1894, the going rate for a captaincy was $10,000, although some men had been known to pay $12,000 to $15,000 in hard currency. At the opposite end of the scale, appointment as a patrolman could be had for $300. Even that was much more than most recruits were able to pay. Examining officers explained kindly that the investment would soon be recouped on the beat. All these sums were a matter of common notoriety when Roosevelt took office. Only 4 months before, an investigating committee of the New York State Senate, headed by Clarence L. Lexow, Republican, had published them in a sensational report recommending an indictment against the Police Department of New York City as a whole. The 10,576-page document, which represented the most searching municipal probe since the days of the Tweed Ring, included a sample police budget as follows. Regular appropriation, $5,139,147.64. Brothel contributions, $8,120,000. Saloon contributions, $1,820,000. Gambling house contributions, $165,000. Merchants, peddlers, etc., $50,000. New members of force, $60,000. Grand total, $15,354,147.64. The fact that such figures were now quoted in guidebooks to the city, along with the height of the Statue of Liberty and the length of the Brooklyn Bridge, was indicative of the weary tolerance with which police bribery was regarded. The memoirs of Commissioners Andrews and Roosevelt differ as to the true extent of corruption in their department in May 1895. Andrews, who had a military fondness for men in uniform, believed that the great majority of the rank and file were honest and efficient. Graft was largely confined to certain senior officers and their ward men or graft collectors. Roosevelt expressed himself rather more negatively. "From top to bottom," he wrote, The New York police force was utterly demoralized by the gangrene. Venality and blackmail went hand in hand with the basest forms of low ward politics. The policeman, the ward politician, the liquor seller, and the criminal alternately preyed on one another and helped one another to prey on the general public. Of course, the truth lay somewhere between these two extremes. However, both commissioners, in referring to ward men and ward politics, emphasized that the police department was not in business merely for itself. Its traditional function, indeed, was to finance the city's political machines. Often the person collecting contributions around each precinct at the end of the week was not a policeman at all, but an employee of Tammany Hall. The vast sums thus accrued had kept the Democratic organization in power from 1886, the year Abram Hewitt defeated Theodore Roosevelt for mayor, until 1894, when mounting disgust over the Lexow hearings swept the reform ticket to victory. As a result of this near decade of corrupt domination of New York City politics, Tammany Hall had become so solidly entrenched that Mayor Strong's election seemed but a temporary interruption of the status quo.
"Our people could not stand the rotten police corruption," boss Richard Croker admitted. "They'll be back at the next election. They can't stand reform either."
Croker's confidence was based on the fact that the police board also constituted the Board of Elections. This useful quirk in the law gave the four commissioners power to appoint all election officers, prepare and count all ballots, and preserve order, or willful disorder, at the polls. Croker's last tame commissioner on Mulberry Street had boasted that, given control of the police, he cared not how the public voted. Croker could have rigged the last election, as he had others in the past, but being a political realist, he deemed it wiser not to play with the passions aroused by the Lexow investigation. Tammany Hall could afford to put up its shutters for a season or two. Its precinct organization was as perfect as ever, and its financial prospects were excellent. Corruption in the police department would continue. Roosevelt or no Roosevelt.
"Now then, what'll we do?"
Roosevelt's impetuous question sounded odd in the ears of the two reporters as they sat in his office on the first day of his commissionership.
"It was just as if we three were the police board," marveled Lincoln Steffens. "T.R., Reese, and I."
Willing as both men were to suggest what and whom Roosevelt might attack, for he was clearly in a fighting mood, they cautioned him to go a bit slow at first and to discuss a program of reform with his colleagues. But Roosevelt knew he could achieve little in this job by proceeding deliberately. It was about as powerful, in constitutional terms, as his last. Once again, he must exercise his genius for press relations. Instinct told him that these scribes would be of more use to him than the three commissioners now waiting in the hallway. Jacob Reese, at 46, was the most influential reporter in the city. A big, rumpled, noisy, sweet-natured Dane, he had been obsessed with social reform ever since his youth as a penniless immigrant on the Lower East Side. Deep within him, he carried the memory of a policeman beating out the brains of his pet dog against the steps of Church Street Station. In 1890, Reese's documentary book, How the Other Half Lives, illustrated with his own photographs, had shocked all thinking Americans into awareness of the horrors of the ghetto. Not long after its publication, he had found a card from Theodore Roosevelt on his desk with the scrawled message, "I have read your book, and I have come to help." A meeting had been arranged, and the Dane, by his own admission, fell in love at first sight. Now, 5 years later, God had appointed Roosevelt president of the police board. The promised help was at hand. There is no record of Roosevelt's first impression of Lincoln Steffens, but subsequent evidence indicates that he understood the young man shrewdly. Steffens was 29 years old, thin, vain, arrogant, wolfishly ambitious, with the beady eye of a born investigative reporter. He had no false sentiment, unlike Reese, who refused to cover raids on homosexual brothels, on the grounds that there are no such creatures in this world. Roosevelt knew just how to handle Steffens. A mild scoop every now and again, indulgent nods when he ventured some criticism, a few flattering requests for advice, like, "Now then, what'll we do?" And the reporter would be his man. In return, Roosevelt could be sure of a constant supply of raw political information and much useful gossip. Commissioner Parker was not pleased at having to wait outside Roosevelt's office and was heard to grumble, "Thinks he's the whole board." For most of that first day, however,
the four new colleagues acted harmoniously. They laughed and chatted together, and each seemed pleased with his agreed-on responsibilities. Parker was given the glamorous and important job of reorganizing the Detective Bureau. Roosevelt showed further confidence in his political integrity by naming him chairman of the Committee of Elections. Grant was made overseer of repairs and supplies and chairman of the Disciplinary Committee. The military Andrews was asked to draw up a new set of rules designed to tighten efficiency and ensure accountability in the ranks, in addition to his duties as treasurer. Roosevelt, who enjoyed ex officio a seat on all committees, announced that he would concern himself with problems of overall administration and would act as press spokesman for the entire board. Just how successful he was in the latter capacity may be judged from the following collage of newspaper headlines and cartoon captions representing his first 10 days in office. Roosevelt's new girl secretary, the police board president, causes sensation on Mulberry Street. Reign of terror at police headquarters. Merritt wins promotion now. Political polls frowned upon. Rattled, the dry old police bones. Kick the politicians, lecture the legislature, snub the roundsmen, warn the drunken bluecoats, abolish the police parades, and stir up departmental surgeons. Roosevelt as judge. The reform commissioner tries nearly 100 policemen in one day. Polls found worthless before the inquisitor, with big teeth and rasping voice. A subhead in The World summed up the new commissioner's policy in these words: publicity, publicity, publicity. He seemed determined to expose to general scrutiny every aspect of his department's work, from transcripts of board meetings to dossiers on the moral fitness of officers for promotion. His habit of inviting reporters to spend the day in his big, bare office made it difficult for the representatives of political organizations to have private speech with him. Whenever the politicians began to whisper, he would deliberately answer, in a voice loud enough to be heard across the room. The white glare of all this publicity inevitably focused much attention upon Roosevelt the man. A lead article in The World of 17 May shows with what clarity he stamped his image on the pages of the press. Although the article purported to describe a routine trial of police officers for infractions of discipline, it dwelt with fascinated relish upon the judge's physical peculiarities and survives as a documentary portrait of Theodore Roosevelt at 36. When he asks a question, Mr. Roosevelt shoots it at the poor trembling policeman as he would shoot a bullet at a coyote. He shows a set of teeth calculated to unnerve the bravest of the finest. His teeth are very white and almost as big as a colt's teeth. They are broad teeth. They form a perfectly straight line. The lower teeth look like a row of dominoes. They do not lap over or under each other, as most teeth do, but come together evenly. They seem to say, "Tell the truth to your commissioner, or he'll bite your head off." Generally speaking, this interesting commissioner's face is red. He has lived a great deal out of doors, and that accounts for it. His hair is thick and short. Under his right ear, he has a long scar. It is the opinion of all the policemen who have talked with him that he got that scar fighting an Indian out west. It is also their opinion that the Indian is dead. But Mr. Roosevelt's voice is the policeman's hardest trial. It is an exasperating voice, a sharp voice, a rasping voice. It is a voice that comes from the tips of his teeth and seems to say in its tones, "What do you amount to anyway?" One thing our noble force may make up its mind to at once: it must do as Roosevelt says, for it is not likely that it will succeed in beating him. Jacob Riis, reporting another trial for the Evening Sun, noted how impossible it was for Roosevelt to yield conduct of the court to any of his colleagues. Within a quarter of an hour, although Andrews had the chair, he was putting all the questions and interrupting most of the answers. Once or twice he turned to Commissioner Andrews and apologized, but by the time the third case ended, there was no longer any apparent need to do that. Andrews did not mind being upstaged, and Grant liked nothing so much as to sit and stare into space, but Parker, Roosevelt quickly sensed, needed careful handling. Fortunately, the Democrats seemed to prefer working behind the scenes. Immaculate of trouser leg, dark and glossy of beard, he would loll in his chair with fingers intertwined, smiling easily and often. He projected an air of fashionable languor, coming to work late, leaving early, not bothering to attend many board meetings. Yet there was a certain sinister efficiency about the way he got things done that Roosevelt greatly admired. Parker is my mainstay, he wrote Lodge. He is able and forceful, but a little inclined to be tricky. Andrews is good, but timid, and sticks in the bark. Grant is a good fellow, but dull and easily imposed on. He is our element of weakness. Roosevelt found his new duties absorbingly interesting, and threw himself into them with animal vigor. His daily arrival at Mulberry Street became a ritual entertainment for the stoop-sitters of No. 303. About 8:30 he would come around the corner of Bleecker Street, walking with a springy tread, goggling his spectacles enthusiastically at everything around, about, and behind him. There was a rapid increase in pace as he drew near police headquarters, followed by a flying ascent of the front steps. Ahead of him, in the lobby, a uniformed porter would step into the waiting elevator and reach for its controls. But by that time, Roosevelt, feet blurring, was already halfway up the stairs. Arriving on the second floor with no perceptible rise or fall of his chest, he would scurry across the hallway into his office, overlooking the street. Here, one morning, a reporter was on hand to note that he swings the chair, sits down, and takes off his glasses and his hat, all so quickly that he appears to be doing everything at once. Replacing the glasses with pince-nez, Roosevelt would fling his attention at the first document in front of him. Read, digested, and acted upon, the item would be given to his girl secretary for filing, or, often as not, dispensed with in Rooseveltian fashion, i.e. crushed into a ball and hurled to the floor. By the end of the day, the area around his desk was ankle-deep in paper jetsam. "I wonder he does not wear himself out," sighed Commissioner Grant. On 13 May, Roosevelt admitted to Bammy, who was now on an extended stay in London and had rented him her house at 689 Madison Avenue, that "I have never worked harder than in these last 6 days." In subsequent letters, he altered the clause to read, "the last 2 weeks," and "the last 4 weeks." Hard as it was to familiarize himself with every detail of police bureaucracy, there was the intense additional frustration of finding himself without real administrative authority. "I have to deal with 3 colleagues, solve terribly difficult problems, and do my work under hampering laws," he wrote in one of his perennial cries for power. "I have the most important and corrupt department in New York on my hands. I shall speedily assail some of the ablest, shrewdest men in this city who will be fighting for their lives, and I know how hard the task ahead of me is. Yet in spite of all the nervous strain and worry, I am glad I undertook it, for it is a man's work." Being congenitally unable to function unless he had some symbols of evil to attack, Roosevelt looked about him for an opponent. As usual, he selected the biggest and nearest. "I think I shall move against Burns at once," he told Lodge on 18 May. "I thoroughly distrust him, and cannot do any thorough work while he remains." The chief of police was not afraid of righteous persecution. He had survived threats against himself and against the business, as policemen were wont to call their profession, many times before. "It will break you," he warned Roosevelt. "You will yield. You are but human." Yet for a colossus, he toppled with surprising ease. 9 days after Roosevelt's declaration, Burns was out. The same law which had so recently elevated him to supreme command of the force also permitted him to retire on full pension, along with any other officer who had served 25 years and wished to escape embarrassing questions from the Reform Board. Threatened with public investigation, he handed in his resignation on 28 May and strode heavily out of police headquarters. "Men stopped and stood to watch him go, silent, respectful, sad," wrote Lincoln Steffens. And the next day, the world went on as usual. A second symbolic departure in the last week of May was that of Inspector Clubber Williams. This notoriously brutal officer had earned his nickname Cracking Skulls on the Lower East Side, while also earning a fortune which he solemnly ascribed to real estate speculation in Japan. Williams was the pet peeve of Steffens, who told Roosevelt he would love to see him fired. "Well, you will," was the answer. A few days later, 24 May, T.R. threw up his second-story window, leaned out, and yelled his famous cowboy call, "Hi-yi-yi!" He often summoned Reese and me thus. When we poked our heads out of my window across the street this time, he called me alone. "Not you, Jake. Steffens, come up here." I hurried over to his office, and there in the hall stood Williams, who glared as usual at me with eyes that looked like clubs. I passed on in to T.R., who bade me sit down on a certain chair in the back of the room. Then he summoned Williams and fired him. That is to say, he forced him to retire. It was done almost without words. Williams had been warned. The papers were all ready. He signed there, rose, turned and looked at me, and disappeared. According to Commissioner Andrews, the resignations of Burns and Williams shook the force from top to bottom. Men in the ranks felt puzzled and insecure in the power vacuum that followed. They hesitated to accept Roosevelt's authority until Acting Chief Peter Conlon, a quiet, colorless ex-inspector, revealed whose side he was on. In the meantime, there could be no doubt that the president of the board had scored a double personal triumph. Roosevelt boasted publicly that the work of reforming the force was half done because it was well begun. The world agreed with him. More than half the difficulty of police reform lay in the principle of corruption inherent in the old machine organization, and firmly established by years of toleration. The removal of Burns and Williams renders the further work of improvement comparatively easy. Roosevelt now turned his attention to questions of efficiency and discipline in the force. With shrewd flair for melodrama, he chose to begin his investigations at night. Shortly after 2 a.m. on 7 June 1895, a stocky, bespectacled figure emerged from the Union League Club and stood on the steps overlooking Fifth Avenue. Although the night was warm, he turned the collar of his evening coat up and pulled a soft hat low over his eyes. Presently, a shaggy man in dark green glasses joined him, and the pair began walking eastward along 42nd Street. Some suspicious club attendants, accompanied by a night watchman, followed them until satisfied that whatever mischief they planned was going to take place somewhere else. Turning down Third Avenue, Roosevelt and his companion, who was none other than Jacob Riis, walked south as far as 27th Street without seeing a single policeman. Second Avenue was better patrolled, in that at least one officer was on the beat. But as the hours wore on, and the searchers continued to prowl around the east side, it became apparent that New York's finest were also among its rarest. Roosevelt and Riis were standing outside an all-night restaurant when the owner came out, rapped the sidewalk with a stick, and gazed angrily up and down the deserted street.
"Where in thunder does that copper sleep?" he asked,
unaware that he was addressing the president of the police board. Later, Roosevelt swooped incognito upon a roundsman and two patrolmen conversing outside a corner liquor store.
"Why don't you two men patrol your posts?"
The loiterer seemed inclined to respond violently until he introduced himself, whereupon they marched off in a hurry. Elsewhere, Roosevelt discovered an officer snoring on a butter tub and another, partly concealed, as the Tribune discreetly put it, by petticoats. The result of this expedition was that the commissioner had six names and numbers entered in his pocketbook by 7:15 a.m., when he returned to Mulberry Street to begin the next day's work. A reporter noted that he looked tired and worn as he strode up the steps of headquarters. Yet he was obviously in a good humor, so much so he could not bring himself to punish the offenders when they were brought before him at 9:30. However, he announced afterwards that,
"I certainly shall deal severely with the next roundsman or patrolman I find guilty of any similar shortcomings."
Newspaper coverage that afternoon and the following morning was everything he could have desired. "Roosevelt as roundsman," one headline declaimed. "Policemen didn't dream the president of the board was catching them napping," read another. "He makes the night hideous for sleepy patrolmen," reported a third. Even more gratifying were fulsome editorials of praise in other cities as well as New York. It was generally agreed that a new epoch had begun in the police department and that Roosevelt, not Peter Conlon, was its real chief. The Brooklyn Times rejoiced that wanton clubbing of New Yorkers would now decline. No cop would wish his nightstick to collide with the head of the ubiquitous Theodore. The Washington Star suggested that all members of the force should memorize Roosevelt's features so as to be prepared for trouble whenever teeth and spectacles came out of the darkness. On his next night patrol, which took place in the small hours of 14 June, Roosevelt was accompanied by Commissioner Andrews and Richard Harding Davis, the roving correspondent of Harper's Monthly. The three young men entered the 13th Precinct, on the Lower East Side, soon after midnight, and began a systematic search of its clammy caverns. This was distinctly ghetto territory. Ill-lit, badly sanitized, the air around Union Market heavy with the smells of schmaltz and blood-soaked kosher salt.
Roosevelt, who as president of the police board was also a member of the Board of Health, made a note to hasten the closing of the long-condemned slaughterhouse. What policemen could be seen wandering through pale orbs of gaslight were all doing their duty conscientiously.
"You're to be congratulated, sir," said Roosevelt,
materializing in front of a startled sergeant at 1:55 a.m.
"This precinct is well patrolled."
He visited the station house men's room and emerged laughing. Its graffiti included a sketch of himself prowling the streets. Clearly, the message was getting through to the ranks. The only delinquent discovered on the whole east side that night was Patrolman William E. Rath, who forsook his beat for an oyster saloon on Upper Third Avenue. Here, according to the Excise Herald, the following dialogue took place. Roosevelt, entering.
"Why aren't you on your post, officer?"
Rath, deliberately swallowing oyster.
"What the blank is it to you?"
Counterman.
"You got a good nerve coming in here and interfering with an officer."
Roosevelt.
"I'm Commissioner Roosevelt."
Rath, reaching for vinegar bottle.
"Yes, you are. You're Grover Cleveland and Mayor Strong all in a bunch, you are. Move on now, or—"
Counterman, in a horrified whisper.
"Shut up, Bill. It's his nibs. Sure. Don't you spot his glasses?"
Roosevelt, authoritatively.
"Go to your post at once."
Exit, patrolman, running. At 3 a.m., the night walkers retired to Mike Lyon's all-night restaurant on the Bowery for steaks, salad, and beer. Little notice was taken of them at first, until an alert reporter identified the two commissioners, and word spread quickly from table to table. Even the chef came out to stare. Roosevelt was obliged to hold an impromptu press conference before he could proceed with his steak. Refreshed, he escorted his companions over to the west side for a tour of the 15th and 19th precincts, the latter being the notorious Tenderloin District. Here, things were much less satisfactory. No fewer than 7 patrolmen were found to be off their posts, including 3 who had literally to be awakened to a sense of their duties. Roosevelt jotted down their names and numbers in his pocketbook and, much later in the day, handed the list to Chief Conlon, saying,
"This time there will be no mercy."
At the disciplinary hearing, he himself appeared as a complainant. These and subsequent nocturnal jaunts delighted the citizens of New York, who for years had been starved of entertaining municipal news. No such eccentric behavior by a public official had ever been recorded. The somnambulant commissioner was nicknamed Harun L. Roosevelt, after the caliph who liked to stalk unrecognized through Baghdad after dark. Cartoons were published of policemen trembling before drugstore displays of false teeth and spectacles. One enterprising peddler showed up on Mulberry Street with a sack load of celluloid dentures, each equipped with a toy whistle and wire tooth grippers.
"This is the way Rosie whistles," the peddler cried,
clipping on a set and hissing convincingly at passerby. The dentures sold as fast as he could fish them out of the bag, and Mulberry Street began to resound with shrilling noises. Whether Rosie heard the racket in his second-floor office is unknown, but a Captain Grew quickly emerged from headquarters and arrested the peddler for doing unlicensed business. Roosevelt inspected the teeth later and allowed that they were very pretty. With his instinct for public relations, he must have known that the merchandising of one's features, even those most regrettably prominent, is a sure sign of popular acceptance. He had won a wide reputation before, of course, but only in the sense that a few thousand editors, columnists, political observers, and sophisticated newspaper readers across the country knew who he was and what he stood for. But here in his hand was the first tactile proof that his image was working its way into the folk consciousness of America. These celluloid teeth grinned cheerful news, and he could not but delight in them. The exact number of midnight patrols Roosevelt took in the summer of 1895 is a mystery. Certainly there were others. But for some reason, after the first 2 or 3, he discouraged the press from publicizing them. Avery Andrews mentions one expedition which Lincoln Steffens was allowed to attend on condition that he did not write about it. Possibly Roosevelt wished to keep the tactical advantage of surprise, knowing that a retinue of reporters would inevitably spread word of his coming and going around the precincts. In any case, his daytime activities were by then so controversial as to preclude every inch of available column space. Although the nights of vigilance wearied him, each involved going without sleep for about 40 hours, he took great pride in them and saw many things that broadened his social understanding.
tramping along what must have been hundreds of miles of silent avenues lit only by corner lamps and the occasional flickering torch of an oyster cart, he could sense, if not feel, the ache of homelessness and poverty. In alleys and courtyards to left and right, he could gaze through open windows at the hot intimacies of tenement life and listen to the bedlam of alien conversation. Italian changed to Chinese, German to Yiddish, Russian to Polish, as he moved from block to block, until it was a relief to hear even a few words of broken English. Sometimes he cast about for pearls of street wisdom, as when he asked an Italian vendor what possible monish could be made selling his wares on a deserted street at dead of night. The vendor cheerfully agreed it was no way to prosper.
"What I make on the peanut, I lose on them banan."
"These midnight rambles are great fun," Roosevelt wrote. "My whole work brings me in contact with every class of people in New York. I get a glimpse of the real life of the swarming millions." As always, when he was learning something new, he visibly swelled with pleasure and satisfaction. The waiters and patrons at Mike Lyon's Bowery restaurant got used to seeing him drop in at 2 or 3 in the morning, tired and hungry, yet wreathed in smiles. It was, "Hello, Teddy. How are you, Roosevelt?" all over the room, one regular recalled many years later. Beaming, buoyant, blithe, really happy he was in those days. Roosevelt's happiness did not remain unalloyed for long. He very soon came up against an ugly snag in his efforts on behalf of municipal reform. This was the Sunday excise law, a 38-year-old statute which forbade the sale of intoxicating liquors by saloons on the Sabbath. The law had been reaffirmed in 1892 by a Democratic legislature as a gesture to New York State's large but mainly rural temperance vote. In the city, it was always honored more in the breach than the observance. Some New York mayors, including William Strong, had threatened total enforcement, but gave up an alarm when they felt the passions any such action aroused. Resistance came from all classes. Slum-dwelling workers were not to be denied their weekend refreshments after 6 days and 57 hours of grimy labor. To the large, prosperous German community, a stein of lager after Kirsche was more than a pleasure. It was a folk ritual, hallowed by centuries of tradition in the old world. As for the dudes and swells, quaffing champagne in the privacy of Fifth Avenue clubs, they could only sympathize with tenement kids scampering through the streets with buckets of ale for the family. Nevertheless, the law existed. It was on the statute books, and Roosevelt, as New York City's chief law enforcement official, sooner or later had to define his attitude toward it. He was not a prohibitionist, although he might well have been, given his own abstemious nature, and the frightful death of Elliot Roosevelt still fresh in his memory. As long ago as 1884, he had warned in the Assembly that no more terrible curse could be inflicted on this community than the passage of a prohibitory law, and by his deciding vote had killed just such a measure. His objection was practical rather than moral. "It is idle to hope for the enforcement of a law where 19/20 of the people do not believe in the justice of its provisions." The Sunday Excise Act was only partially prohibitory, but he still considered it altogether too strict. Yet suddenly, on 10 June 1895, the president of the police board called in his officers and instructed them to rigidly enforce the closing of all New York City saloons between midnight Saturday and midnight Sunday. "No matter if you think the law is a bad one, you must see that your men carry out your orders to the letter." Announcing his policy to the press, Roosevelt brushed aside suggestions that it was bound to fail and bound to make him personally unpopular. "I do not deal with public sentiment. I deal with the law. How I might act as a legislator or what kind of legislation I should advise has no bearing on my conduct as an executive officer charged with administering the law. If it proves impossible to enforce it, it will only be after the experiment of breaking many a captain of the police. Moreover, when I get at it, I am going to see if we cannot break the license forthwith of any saloon keeper who sells on Sunday. I shall not let up for one moment in my endeavor to make the police understand that no excuse will be permitted on their part when the law is not observed, and that Sunday by Sunday it is to be enforced more and more rigorously. This applies just as much to the biggest hotel as to the smallest grog shop." It was a declaration of war, harsh and uncompromising, expressed throughout in the first person singular,
with the exception of one we, suggesting that at least a majority of Roosevelt's board backed him up. As a matter of fact, all four commissioners believed that the law should be enforced. Roosevelt was particularly gratified by the public support of my queer, strong, able colleague Parker, far and away the most positive character with whom I have ever worked on a commission. Parker appeared to like him, and Roosevelt was by nature inclined to like everybody at first, so the two men got on excellently. They had many long discussions of the law at headquarters, often continued over dinner in a nearby restaurant, and Roosevelt never doubted Parker's sincere dedication to municipal reform. Yet something about the affable lawyer made him uneasy. If he and I get at odds, we shall have a battle royale. All hopes that Roosevelt might have been indulging in excise rhetoric evaporated on Sunday, 23 June, when astonished saloon-keepers throughout the city found their premises being invaded and warrants served on them when they refused to close. Even the notorious King Callahan, an ex-assemblyman with powerful political connections, was ordered by a rookie to lock up his establishment on Chatham Square. Callahan liked to boast that he had thrown his front door key into the East River the day he opened for business, and he assumed his visitor was joking. But the rookie, whose name was Bork, decisively repeated the order, whereupon Callahan knocked him down. Patrons of the saloon joined in stomping the figure on the floor, but Bork was a wiry youth and rose to lay out all comers with his nightstick. The king was duly served with a summons to appear in Toombs Police Court. The seriousness of this gaffe and Roosevelt's real motive in ordering the saloons closed became evident when Bork arrived at the courthouse a couple of days later and found the chamber packed with professional politicians. A congressman and state senator stood ready to testify on Callahan's behalf. Senior police officials were conspicuously absent. Lincoln Steffens urgently sought out Roosevelt at headquarters. Pat Callahan is a sacred person in the underworld, a symbol, he warned. Roosevelt must defend his rookie, even promote him, if the judge found Callahan guilty. Roosevelt immediately left for the courthouse, but word of his coming preceded him, and Callahan's defense collapsed. Patrolman Bork was upheld. The witness waived examination and was remanded for trial on two charges of violation and assault. Overjoyed, Roosevelt pumped his rookie by the hand. Bork, you have done well. You have shown great gallantry. The board is behind you. He promised to make him a roundsman at the first opportunity. For weeks thereafter, Roosevelt boasted about the downfall of King Callahan with what one reporter described as a castanet-like ecstasy of snapping teeth. It soon became clear that Roosevelt's order to close the saloons had very little to do with temperance principles. It was the logical consequence of his mandate, as he saw it, to root out corruption in the police force. Ill-advised as such a crusade against 19/20 of the people might seem in retrospect, his basic reasoning was in the public interest. Of all the wellsprings of illicit funds in New York City, the corner saloon was the most copious and the most profitable to all concerned. It profited the liquor sellers with $160,000 worth of found money every Sunday. It profited the police, who accepted bribes in order not to enforce the law against them. In particular, it profited Tammany Hall, not only with a percentage of the take, but with a rich harvest of votes upon request, for the saloon was the traditional political center of every neighborhood. A Tammany boss could, with a word to his precinct captain, force the Sunday closing of any establishment which failed to support him. Arrests of this kind always increased dramatically in the weeks before Election Day. Sometimes, to make the situation more Byzantine, boss and saloon-keeper were one and the same person. Roosevelt never tired of pointing out that nearly two-thirds of the political leaders of Tammany Hall have, at one time or another, been in the liquor business. In 1895, there were between 12 and 15,000 saloons in New York City, most of them occupying corner sites with elaborate displays of mahogany and engraved glass. In thirsty neighborhoods, such as Paddy's Market and Germantown, the saloons often occupied all four sides of an intersection. This architectural phenomenon was directly related to the Sunday excise law. A corner site meant that even when the front door was locked on Saturday at midnight, there would be at least one open door down the side street, ostensibly connected with the saloon keeper's living quarters. The flow of friends through this door on Sundays was prodigious. Policemen pretended not to notice the foam on the mustaches of departing guests, although they would conscientiously rattle the front lock
and checked that all shutters were drawn. Within, under flickering gas lights, business went on as usual. Roosevelt was not the first authority to invoke the law that year. Ex-Chief Burns, for example, had arrested a record 334 saloon keepers on one Sunday in January. But as Roosevelt pointed out, his victims had been chosen carefully. The law was enforced with corrupt discrimination. Burns would never have permitted the booking of a King Callahan. Now, everybody was arrested alike, and I took special pains to see that the big men and the men with political influence were treated like everyone else. As a result, 30 June was voted the driest Sunday in 7 years. 97% of the city's watering holes were closed, slowing to a trickle the normal Sunday flow of 3 million glassfuls of beer. Roosevelt bluecoats seemed to be everywhere, waving aside bribes with loathing and writing out summonses at the slightest sign of resistance. Some enterprising saloon keepers sought to evade the law by serving meals with their drinks, in the form of token sandwiches. These were placed on barroom tables on the tacit understanding they were for display purposes only, and left to curl up at the edges while relays of patrons washed them down with liquor. Roosevelt was sternly disapproving and ordered his plainclothesmen to monitor all aging sandwiches in future. The legal ratio, he said, was one drink per sandwich, and they were meant to be consumed simultaneously. He congratulated an exhausted Chief Conlon on his success in closing so many saloons, and urged him to even greater efforts. "This must be kept up." The following Sunday, 7 July, was not quite so dry, due to a growing awareness of legal constraints placed upon the police. They were forbidden, for example, to search persons or premises without visible evidence of alcohol being drunk and bought. Consequently, a strange epidemic of traveling bags, grip sacks, and market baskets was observed in the streets of Gotham. Many hundreds of them were carried out of a cigar store that backed up against Pat Callahan's saloon on Chatham Square. The police knew that a walled awning-shaded garden connected the two establishments, but they were denied permission to enter. It was announced that the king was entertaining his friends, and no longer included cops in that category. In more sophisticated parts of town, coffee vendors found that a heavy infusion of cognac in every cup greatly increased their sales, while at a German Biergarten on Lexington Avenue, requests for lemon soda, plain soda, and cold tea were met with Rhine wine, gin, and whiskey, respectively. Despite all these ingenious evasions, it soon became apparent that Roosevelt's stranglehold on the saloons was beginning to hurt. The Wine, Beer, and Liquor Sellers Association, until recently the richest organization in New York, reported that one quarter of its members were facing bankruptcy for lack of Sunday sales. The New York Times estimated their average weekend loss at over $20,000 each. Economic shockwaves were felt all over the country. In his eagerness to close the New York saloons, remarked the Chicago Tribune, Mr. Roosevelt has interfered with the hop raisers of New York and Washington, with the corned beef ranchers of the plains, the pig's feet producers of the West, and the barley growers of the North. He is in a fair way to cost the American people millions. Anguished protests came in from Tammany politicians, most notably from ex-Governor David B. Hill, now a United States Senator. In an open letter widely seen as a keynote for the upcoming Democratic state campaign, Hill excoriated New York's busybody and notoriety-seeking police commissioners for arbitrary, harsh, and technical enforcement of the Sunday excise law. A glass of beer with a few crackers in a humble restaurant is just as much a poor man's lunch on Sunday as is Mr. Roosevelt's elaborate champagne dinner at the Union League Club. On 12 July, a Democratic judge handed down the alarming decision that the law, interpreted literally, forbade the sale of all drinks on the Sabbath, including milk and lemonade. "Only water to drink now," mourned the Herald. Roosevelt's chance to reply came on 16 July, when he faced a large meeting of German Americans in the Good Government Club at 134 East 115th Street. His audience represented the second biggest ethnic community in New York City. From Houston Street north to Yorkville, from 3rd Avenue east to the river, one might walk for miles and not see so much as an English shop sign. Here lived some 760,000 industrious, beer-drinking burghers, mostly middle class, sentimentally attached to the old world, yet fiercely loyal to their adopted country. Economically and politically,
their votes counted for as much as, if not more than, those of Irish Americans. Their reaction to Roosevelt's speech, his first major statement as president of the Reform Police Board, was therefore eagerly awaited as an indication of how things might go at the next municipal election. Reporters came from as far away as Chicago.